Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Secretary of State Kerry says Egypt has a key role in the international coalition against Islamic extremist militants. And the Ukraine Prime Minister says Putin wants to destroy Ukraine. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says it's increasingly clear that the Islamic State's message of hate is being rejected by the overwhelming majority of Muslims around the world. Kerry says Egypt has a key role to play in countering Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria, reaffirming U.S. support for Egypt's battle against Sinai militants.
I'm comfortable that this will be a broad-based coalition with Arab nations, European nations, with the United States, others contributing to every single different facet of what President Obama laid out as a strategy and fully embracing the need to degrade and destroy ISIL.
Kerry says IS jihadists claiming to be fighting on behalf of Islam are actually being rejected with their message of hate by the majority of Muslims. He met today with Arab League chief Nabil El Arabi and Egyptian President Abdul Al Fattah. Ugandan authorities have discovered what they call a terrorist cell run by the Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab, believed to have been planning an attack in the very near future. Officials at the U.S. Embassy in Kampala announced the development today, saying Uganda has increased security at key sites, including Entebbe International Airport. Authorities did not release information on specific targets. Nigeria's military says it has fought off an attack by Boko Haram militants outside the capital of the northeastern state of Borno and sent reinforcements in for the city. Military officials say the Islamist militants launched an attack Friday against the town of Kanduga, about 35 kilometers outside of the state capital of Maiduguri, suffering heavy casualties during several hours of fighting. This is VOA News. Ukraine's prime minister says Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to destroy Ukraine as an independent country in spite of a truce deal. Speaking at an international conference today in Kiev, Arseniy Yatsenyuk.
His goal is to take the entire Ukraine. He cannot cope with an idea that Ukraine would be a part of big EU family. He wants to restore the Soviet Union.
Prime Minister Yatsenyuk praised the new wave of economic sanctions imposed on Russia by the West. Meantime, another convoy of Russian trucks claiming to carry humanitarian aid crossed into Ukraine overnight, heading for the city of Luhansk. The observer mission of the OSCE at the Donetsk checkpoint reported 220 vehicles were not inspected by Ukrainian officials or the Red Cross for their contents. Pope Francis says the many conflicts around the world today could be considered a piecemeal World War III. Speaking today at Italy's memorial to 100,000 of its soldiers who died in World War I, the Pope described the current skirmishes and war as being fought with crimes, massacres, and destruction. The Pope has made repeated appeals in recent months for an end to the conflicts in Ukraine, Iraq, Syria, Gaza, and parts of Africa. The armies of India and Pakistan are stepping up efforts to evacuate thousands of people stranded by some of the worst monsoon flooding the region has seen in decades. More than a week of heavy rains have led to floods and landslides washing away houses and bridges, killing at least 474 people in both countries. An army spokesman from Pakistan says the troops have been instructed to make all possible efforts to rescue flood victims.
Don't wait for orders, and human life is the most important thing. Therefore, go to any extent to save human lives.
Officials say flooding has affected more than 1.8 million people, leaving hundreds of thousands homeless. The flooding is particularly bad in the Indian-controlled parts of Kashmir and in Pakistan's eastern Punjab province. The head of the World Health Organization says more and better-trained medical workers are needed in West Africa to stop the growing outbreak of Ebola. Dr. Margaret Chan, speaking at a news conference in Geneva on Friday, said the outbreak's death toll has climbed past 2,400, with a total number of cases at 4,700. She said officials need more trained healthcare workers.
We still need at least 500 to 600 doctors, coming from, both the country and foreign medical team, and at least over 1,000 or more healthcare workers to mend the existing centers.
The WHO said this week that Ebola has now killed nearly 80 healthcare workers in Liberia, the country hardest hit. And South African track star Oscar Pistorius has been found not guilty of murder charges, but instead guilty of culpable homicide. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. Welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
We're almost 6 months into the experience of Ebola, and the numbers are growing exponentially.
A United Nations envoy describes the outbreak of the Ebola virus disease in Liberia as a tragedy for the West African nation.
A typical hydropower project, you would say, takes 2 years to develop it. With solar, we took the site in February, and it's completed and already giving electricity in July.
East Africa's biggest solar power plant opens in Rwanda.
And they might have infections and bleeding, pain, and they will suffer all their lives, really.
And in Egypt, the first ever female genital mutilation trial begins this week. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. We start off in Liberia, where the outbreak of the Ebola virus disease has been described by the top UN envoy in the country as a tragedy for the West African nation. Karen Landgren, the head of the UN mission in Liberia, was at UN headquarters on Tuesday to brief the Security Council on the situation in the country. Liberia is working to build state institutions and consolidate stability with the help of the UN mission there, following a civil war which ended in 2003. Ms. Landgren told UN Radio's Derek Imbata that Liberia, which has suffered so much, is now facing the challenge of the Ebola outbreak.
I told the Security Council that Ebola was a tragedy for Liberia. We're almost 6 months into the experience of Ebola, and the numbers are growing exponentially. The numbers that we know are very high, with over 1,200 deaths suspected or probable. But the World Health Organization has warned us that these aren't the real numbers.
What is being done to tackle this outbreak?
The health experts agree on what needs to be done. But what needs to be done is difficult to do in the context of Liberia. Liberia had a weak health facility, a weak public health capacity, even before this crisis, and Ebola has caused it to collapse. So the measures that need to be taken are that people need to protect themselves against disease transmission. In Liberia, this means taking care in caring for the sick. This has been a big route of transmission until now. And also taking care in traditional funeral rites, which involve often touching, washing the body, and have been the source of many, many new infections. Those who are sick have to have places to go to be cared for, holding centers, isolation centers, case management facilities of some sort. But because Ebola carries such risks, those who manage facilities have to be meticulous in their practices, in their decontamination, and so on.
Now, are the ordinary people in Liberia aware of these precautions that they have to take in order to prevent contracting Ebola?
Some people are aware, and we see from the increasing number of people bringing the sick to facilities in Monrovia that they know they're not supposed to care for them themselves. Some communities are very remote. I was told last week about a community that's 6 or 7 hours walk from the nearest road. Someone had gone and discovered 35 fresh graves. The assumption is that this was Ebola. Some communities have been in denial, believing that Ebola was a trick, a myth, a curse on some communities. So it hasn't always been easy to get the message through. We need religious leaders and traditional leaders to convince their people that this is real.
Are religious and traditional leaders playing any role to ensure that the people are becoming more aware of the dangers of Ebola?
Religious and traditional leaders are playing a major role. A few weeks ago, I was visiting a community in Tieni, in the north of the country, close to the border with Sierra Leone. And an imam got up in this group and said to me, "We have accepted the virus." Strange formulation, but I understood perfectly what he was saying. His community is not in denial. He's part of spreading the knowledge which is the best vaccine against Ebola.
As you may be aware, in Africa, we also have these traditional healers who provide services to people. Do they play any role here in Liberia as far as this Ebola is concerned?
Traditional healers and chemists' shops are places people have turned to with the collapse of the regular hospital system. And we're afraid some traditional healers and definitely some pharmacists have themselves come down with EVD. So they are a high-risk group. They're also a very important group that needs to change their practices and spread the right message. We have concerns about healthcare workers across the board. They are on the front lines of this. Many of them have had weak training, have not had the protective gear they need, and have not even been paid in some cases for several months.
Does Liberia have the resources to be able to tackle this challenge, given what you have just told me?
Liberia has been very open in saying it can't do this alone. The government is very stretched. They need to come back to the international community setting out their needs, but we're already hearing that maybe salaries of government staff won't be able to be paid in the coming months. The economy was scheduled to grow at 5.9%. That's been reduced downward to 2.9%. The finance minister has talked about a budget gap of approximately $116 million. There'll be a severe revenue shortfall because some of the main producers have slowed down their activities. Some staff are being laid off. So a big part of this is retaining the confidence of the investors in the country that the country will weather this crisis of Ebola. But to do that, a lot needs to happen quickly. There's really no substitute for having the massive surge of health workers. They need to be equipped. There need to be adequate logistics. Some decisions have to be taken very quickly to let this happen.
I was Karen Landgren, the head of the UN mission in Liberia. She spoke with UN Radio's Derek Mbata at the UN headquarters in New York. In Uganda, authorities have discovered what they call a terrorist cell run by the Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab that was believed to have been planning an attack on the very near future. Officials at the U.S. Embassy in Kampala announced the development Saturday, saying Uganda has increased security at key sites, including Entebbe International Airport. Authorities did not release information on any specific targets. The U.S. Embassy advised citizens visiting Uganda to stay home or in a safe location and monitor new reports until the all clear is issued. The biggest solar plant in East Africa has just opened in Rwanda. It's the first grid-level solar plant in the region, a 21-hectare field covered with panels. Rwanda might not seem an obvious place to put it, as the country averages only about 5 hours of sunshine per day and not much more where the plant is located. But as VOA's Nick Long reports, sunshine is not the whole story.
Until last month, South Africa was the only country in sub-Saharan Africa to have a substantial amount of solar power feeding into its grid. Ghana has great plans for solar energy, but cloudy Rwanda has overtaken the West Africans by actually completing a large-scale photovoltaic, or PV, solar park. The one just opened at the Agahozo Shalom village in eastern Rwanda has peak capacity of 8.5 megawatts, nearly 7% of capacity on the national grid. The government has signed a power purchase agreement, or PPA, to pay for that electricity over 25 years. So why is Rwanda seizing the lead on solar power in East Africa? Owner and chief operating officer of Afritech, the firm that built the plant, Dan Klink, suggests some reasons.
Rwanda is doing a number of different things right. I mean, one, they have security, a place where people can trust their PPAs for 25 years. Geopolitical stability, Rwanda is probably the most attractive place in East Africa. Rwanda's regulatory framework, no corruption. It's a very, very, very transparent system.
The deal had to be right for the Rwandan government as well as for the investors. The exact price it will pay for the electricity from the Agahozo plant is confidential, but VOA was told it's between 20 and 25 US cents per kilowatt, around twice as expensive as most hydropower. But Rwanda still gets nearly half its electricity from diesel, and that electricity costs 38 cents per kilowatt in Rwanda. Solar power fluctuates, so the Rwandan government does not want more than 10% solar on its grid. But it needs that 10% quickly to save on diesel and to give Rwanda's fledgling industries a chance of competing. And solar power can be rolled out fast.
A typical hydropower project, you would say, takes 2 years of development. With solar, we took the site in February, and it's completed and already giving electricity in July. So you're talking 6 months versus 2 years.
Villagers who were farming on the 21-hectare site said they were happy with the compensation they got for their land and are looking forward to the electricity. But much of rural Rwanda will have to wait years for a grid connection. For them, solar home systems, panels on the roof, could be a solution. A German company, Mobisol, offers Rwandans a system that powers several lamps, a phone charger, a flashlight, and a radio, all of which come with the package at a cost of $10 a month over 3 years. Mobisol marketing manager David Gasirabo says 80% of Rwandan households could afford that.
To be honest with you, almost all of them can afford it. If you choose to have light, then it's possible.
Mobisol's manager in Rwanda, Klaus Meyer, mentioned a drawback with solar panels. While they need sunshine to work, they do not function well if they get too hot.
I think for solar parks or mini-grids, this is truly an issue, that if the panel or the park heats up, your performance or your efficiency just goes down. Therefore, probably Rwanda is a good spot for having a mini-grid or having a solar park.
The Agahozo Park has more than 28,000 solar panels and was built at a cost of $23.7 million. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
In Egypt, a health ministry inspector testified Thursday in that country's first ever female genital mutilation FGM trial, saying a 13-year-old girl died after undergoing the procedure, despite her doctors claiming otherwise. FGM has been illegal in Egypt for 6 years, but activists say most Egyptian girls are still being circumcised, mostly in private clinics. Heather Maddock has more for VOA from Beirut.
الام او المراه هي اللي باينه هي اللي بتاخد بنتها وتوديها عند الدكتور
ايوه بس بيبقى قرار الام اكتر من قرار
الام بس الرجل
On this Egyptian talk show women discuss female circumcision also known as FGM One woman says parents fear that if they don't circumcise their girls for purity no one will marry them or if they do the new husband may force his bride to be circumcised on their wedding night But Saud Aboudeya, a Middle East and North Africa consultant for Equality Now, says if a girl is circumcised, she will never enjoy her sexual relationship with her husband, among other things.
And they might have infections and bleeding, pains, and they will suffer all their lives, yani.
Aboudeya traveled to the Egyptian countryside to attend the trial of Dr. Rasselin Fadl, who allegedly circumcised 13-year-old Soher Albatia at her father's request. After the procedure, Albatia died from an allergic reaction to penicillin. If convicted, Fadl could be sentenced to up to 2 years in prison and a $700 fine. The father also faces lesser criminal charges, and a decision is expected September 25th. In court on Thursday, Aboudeya says a health ministry inspector testified that the procedure Fadl performed was a circumcision, not treating genital warts, as the doctor claimed. Aboudeya says if the doctor is convicted in this case, it could reduce the amount of girls that are circumcised by letting people know that it's not just a crime in Egypt on paper.
We believe that this is a very important case because this is the first case that goes to the court. This will be a lesson to the doctors who perform FGM to watch out and that FGM is criminalized by law.
More than half of Egyptian women are circumcised, and the practice is more common in the countryside among both Muslims and Christians. Most of the procedures are performed in private clinics, but many villages also have a midwife trained to cut. Some activists fear that if Fadl is convicted, more doctors would refuse to do the procedure, and more girls would essentially be operated on at home, in unsanitary conditions and without anesthesia. And this already happens a lot.
ما راح جابونا واحده عندنا اسمها دي اسمها فاطمه ظريف ولسه فاكره لها دلوقتي
فاطمه اسم الدايه فاطمه ظريف.
Later on the talk show, a woman cloaked in black says when she was about 9 years old, she and 6 or 7 other girls were circumcised with the same unwashed blade. The pain was excruciating for days, she says. But the only comfort her mother, also circumcised, could offer was to suggest that she swim in the canal. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Beirut.
Two young South Africans have established one of the country's most successful tattoo parlors, black and white tattoos, in the Johannesburg suburb of Rosebank. Tiplo Sotesi and Dave Smith are part of a new wave of tattooists who place ethics and responsibility ahead of profits. They refuse, for example, to do tattoos depicting violence, insisting that their interest lies in doing positive, hopeful pieces, like all the tattoos they have been commissioned to do since Nelson Mandela's death, inspired by the South African human rights hero. Darren Taylor reports for VOA in this fourth installment of our series on remarkable enterprises in South Africa.
The muscular man with a shaved head grimaces at the needle dancing across his broad chest. The inky Gothic letters of a Latin phrase begin to form on his skin. Amor vincit omnia. Love conquers all.
The first 5 minutes takes some getting used to. It's uncomfortable, but then you start to enjoy the pain afterwards.
Zane Collier, a lifestyle coach, is spread-eagled on a metal stretcher. At the mercy of master tattooist Tiplo Tsotsetsi, inside the studio of black and white tattoos.
I start to fall asleep or go into like a hypnotic state, so I forget about it. Yeah, the only thing is that you get very hungry. That's the only thing that I don't like.
You get hungry?
I get hungry. I want to eat the whole time.
And you can't eat while it's going.
Tsotsetsi plays some chilled music to relax Collier. The tall, dreadlocked tattooist twirls a matte black and silver electronic needle. He says he and his partner, Dave Smith, work with their clients to create original tattoos.
Give us your idea, then we'll work on your design. And to be fresh, we don't want to go to the net and just choose one and do that, because you'll find that thousands of people got the same tattoo around there. You know, we want something unique, something that's going to be you, with different technique on it.
Smith is a stocky young man with a thick brown beard. He wears a green beanie and blue surgical gloves as he completes a tattoo on a customer's back. Smith says some people ask for tattoos on unbelievable parts of their bodies.
I'd say the most crazy one was just above someone's genitalia, yeah? He wanted it on the genitalia, and we denied him that. We're like, no, if you're going to be realistic, you must treat us like realistic people, you know? Like, that's not art, that's something else, you know?
Tsotsetsi says some people want tattoos to reflect their adherence to dark religious practices, as he puts it.
It's certain beliefs that I can't mention, so we can't do them, because even out there, they have like a negative feeling amongst people, and more like
some people come in here and ask for like satanic symbols.
Yeah, symbols. Like in ignorance and in stupidity, like, hello, I would like to get this on my throat, or I'd like to get this, and I'm like, no, my friend, let's do that.
Tsotsetsi says demand for Nelson Mandela-inspired tattoos spiked dramatically the day after his death.
I had so many people coming here to get Mandela portraits, getting Mandela codes, getting that, yeah.
He's tattooed a portrait of the smiling icon on the chest of customer David Holland. Holland says he got the tattoo because Mandela made all his values come true.
At the end of the day, I make it personal for myself. Mandela didn't fight for the freedom of South Africa and for himself. He fought for my freedom. So because he fought for my freedom, I get to have a black tattoo artist, a black business partner, Mauritian fiance, later on in life, when my kids ask me who's that person, I can say mommy and daddy got to be together because this person made sure that everyone could interact and be together normally.
A As he works on a big blonde man, Smith says all his customers fascinate him when they speak about the inspiration behind their tattoos, from drug abuse to falling in and out of love, to spells in prison, to the violent deaths of friends.
And they said, no, if you've got a good tattoo artist, you don't need a therapist at all, you know? Yeah. Which is true. You'll see all these guys with main good pieces. You must know they've got some serious stories to tell, you know? Interesting people, though. It's expressive people. So
Tetsi describes his clientele as an eclectic mix.
The other day I was tattooing a lawyer, then 2 hours later, you could see that this guy, you know, is like the opposite of lawyer, straight opposite, you know. You can see like somehow they can work together. One might need help from the other, you know. We get bank managers, we get priests, we get like students, we get all people.
When they've completed their tattoos for the day, Smith blasts heavier music. And Sotetsi reflects on the fact that many of his customers are now women.
Men used to get big tattoos, but now your girls, they get sleeves, they, you know, because they understand tattoos better. Once they get that freedom of expressing themselves, they don't stop, you know, they just continue with it.
Yeah.
He says women do more research on their tattoos, are less impulsive than men, and more open to suggestions, and also braver, adds Smith.
The tattoos they get, it's on places that men would squeal and cry and the girls would be like calm and chilled about it. They just sit here and they won't even have that,
easy.
The men, you can actually see, like when you tattoo them, how they take it. They don't take it too great, you know. They take it, maybe it's us with a heavier hand on, I don't even know.
The next day, the partners are back at their posts, their needles creating more art on human skin. Because, they say, it means that their work lives and breathes on the bodies of housewives in shopping malls, under press suits in corridors of power, under robes behind pulpits, under overalls in jails. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, African leaders countrywide have long sought a solution to the so-called brain drain, losing their brightest young minds to jobs in the West or Asia. Now many talented African students who study abroad are finding opportunities to apply their skills at home. We'll examine a new trend among Africa's top intellectual talent. That's next time on VOA Africa. VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked. VOA Africa. Don't miss.
VOA Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
You're listening to Nightline Africa here on The Voice of America. And coming up in the second half of the program, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Yes, indeed, it's time for our Saturday music spot. So just sit back, relax, and enjoy this wonderful music.
Makutera na happiness. Lekera ho kumbusa busa. Amazima kaba kamura likaba ba be be be. Bikeke ye, bigambo ya we bisengeje. Biegendereze bitali chakusare pine miniko. Zikeke ye, ngeso sa we zisengeje. Zegendereze zitali chakusare pine miniko. Serious day, what have I no can choose a halio by Javanya Tacotias? Am I so no let him put him in the no sick and no be my hemaka can the high tagi. Over to lastless, make your order before I useless. Come wait to shameless, think you be the cucumberly hopeless. Like a hope, Musa was a. Morali kababa pepe pe bikeke ye bigambo byawe bisengeje yegendereze bitali chakusare pine biniko zikeke ye ngeso sawe zisengeje zegendereze zitali chakusare pine miniko.
Twee sa kali gbera mweyo muga katonda poluka dala tubala mulavu ngetungo yako ya Kasoli mbacha tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Limu katwengo ya goya Nakulandi wa malonyo Ono ya mponye chalo Umanye vinye watavi woma Gabia mpulunguse Nebo vikube noga Muli oulira tebitambula Sawa kwa tono labo mukate wabula mulido Yato lia injini, teri manyama yengo Woma nyivo mkwata, evi omu kwa noto vipapira Masi gansuwa, evi omu kwa no mpola mpola Mama mpola mpola titigite Sikuli mande mkatu mulavu mkwa nengo ya goya Sikuli mengo ya goya, di mkatu engo ya goya Chuma chaka soli mbache tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Limu katwengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Oh, nasalamo Ya mkwata ni mkwata lafu Ya mfunza funza msonda Setu kaya chipoli Eno lafu, entamanya tioline chitiwa Enfuga vya chila lulavu, zentide walai yeah. Lavu, enzime amasu ngomze Sikulimba ni mukatumu lavu, mukwane ngo ya goya Sikulimbe ngo ya goya, e mukatwe ngo ya goya Echumba chaka soli Chitenda na ye mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Ndimu katwengo ya goya Sikuli mbani mkatungu lagu Mkwa mbengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Ndimu katwengo ya goya Echumba chaka soli mba chitenda na ye mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Ndimu katwengo ya goya
Chanenzi jawano kulubindi Kuligwensanga wano nemubu zako Timu nango susotia Tukolera wamu Hera vanjiva manyi Ntenino wange Oh wange Erolumu wandetako Echinso Soka ye waka olonde papa
sirimo munju security guru guru mukumanyo mukumanyo lwako mwagalanyo
mwagalanyo no mwana
mwagalanyo
mwagalanyo chukola bana
mutichisanyo
mutichisanyo ticha ticha
aliwo
She's beautiful. Beautiful.
That tune Nkolechi by Dr. Jose Chameleon brings us to the end of our Saturday Mix Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University in Washington. Take it away, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a great pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S.-Africa relations. The question of ISIS is a Middle Eastern issue, but it certainly has consequences for the rest of the world. So when you look at African relations with the United States, you have to look at the after effects of the summit and the manner in which the after effects of the summit affect all the issues confronting the United States in other parts of the world. There are 2 points I want to emphasize today. In the African context, America is very much preoccupied with terrorism in certain parts of Africa. And this came out clearly in the president's statements to the American people with regard to ISIS. Developments in East Africa, the Horn of Africa, and of course, developments in North Africa and in the Sahara are central issues that connect American policy to Middle Eastern policies. Now, this issue deals with terrorism. And for Americans, they just came out of celebrating the tragedy of 9/11. So as we move forward towards Christmas, we want to see significant progress in terms of American activities in this area of activity. So the question of U.S. foreign policy towards terrorism in the Middle East is very much linked to UN foreign policy in Africa with regard to terrorism. The second point to be borne in mind here is that when you look at what is going on in the Indian Ocean, you see the urgency for a meaningful dialogue between the United States and the Western countries and the BRIC nations. Because if we are going to make any significant breakthrough with regard to containment of terrorism in the Horn of Africa, in the Indian Ocean, and elsewhere on the continent, it calls for a new relationship between the BRIC nations acting as a unit in concert with the United States and other countries in the West that are working in this area. This becomes item number one for the African countries, because if the African governments are working hand in hand together to deal with terrorism and avoid some of the unfortunate developments as in Kenya, we should see how a new relationship is worked out and to make sure that what is going on in the Middle East does not spread into Africa negatively. This should be the interest of the African Union. And when they came up with the summit, this security question becomes very important. And this security question is very much linked to all the issues that have consequences for Africa, and that is health and security. Ebola is a problem. And this came out very well in the speech of President Obama. How can you deal with Ebola and other diseases? It's very much linked to the question of extremism or religious bigots. It's also very much linked to relationship among ethnic groups. This is how the Ebola phenomenon and the terrorism across North Africa And what's going on in the Horn of Africa and in the Indian Ocean are all connected. This leads me to the second point, and that is, how can we engage other countries in this 2014 as we move toward 2015? And that is the development of land grabbing, whether it's done by big powers or by aspiring extremist political organizations, as in ISIS. This is a new development in the history of the world. Because during World War I and World War II, you have the collapse of empires. The Ottoman Empire collapsed. Then you have the situation in Europe, which led to a lot of atrocities. In order for us to avoid this repetition, the Africans who were cannon fodder in World War I should be more concerned this time around not to fall into that trap. So if we talk about African-American relations, we have to really begin to look at the role of business. Business should be central for the African countries. Because if the Africans are going to negotiate effectively with America, they have to open their markets and work out meaningful dialogue. Many thought that the African summit was going that way. There is going to be an urgent need for re-examination of the African summit. And I will not be surprised to see in 2015 another summit in Washington. But this will be carefully tailored, and not all are going to be invited. Only those countries that give legitimate reasons that there is meaningful relationship between them and the United States. The big nations are making inroads in Africa. So this is not a Cold War, but there is an urgent need for the African countries to really look at themselves and see how they can work out a new dialogue with the United States. And this is also a central issue for American leadership to begin to engage Africa between now and 2015 to see to it that we have a new ball game with rules and regulations to determine the relationship between the African countries and America and between America and the rest of the world in light of the changing times. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of us here at the Nightline Africa team, we thank you for joining us tonight. Have a good evening.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
On July 27th, eight men hunting game along the border between South Sudan and the Democratic Republic of the Congo became the quarry instead when they were attacked by an element of the Lord's Resistance Army operating near the DRC's Garamba National Park. In the ensuing fight, an LRA fighter was killed and two women and two children being held captive by the rebel group were rescued. The woman later identified the dead man as Major Thomas Okello Odano, who is thought to have been the rebels' operations commander in the DRC. The LRA has waged a decades-long campaign of murder, rape, and kidnapping across four countries in Central Africa. Under the leadership of men like Okello Odano, it has killed tens of thousands of people and displaced millions. A chance encounter with men brave enough to beat back an LRA attack ended Odano's depredations, but many others like him remain. The United States is committed to supporting efforts by the governments and people of Central Africa to end this threat. As one part of that support, a reward of up to $5 million is offered for the arrest or live capture of any of the LRA's three top leaders, Joseph Kony, Oket Odhiambo, and Dominic Ongwen. You could be rewarded richly for information leading to the arrest of one or all of these men who are charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court. $5 million is enough money to buy 10,000 cattle, to ensure your family's needs are met for the rest of your life, to ensure your children's education, and much more. The people of the United States are committed to ensuring that justice prevails. If you or anyone you know has information on these men or their whereabouts, it can be provided with complete confidentiality. To report information in South Sudan, call 211-912-157-623. In Sudan, call 1-877-022-000, press 0, and ask to speak with security. In DRC, call 243-8171-5-2501 or 243-82-481-9841. And in Uganda, call 256-414-306-040. You may also provide this information to any U.S. government or U.S. military representative. Thank you.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.